Great to have you listening in here on WPR News. Time to take a look at the world of insects. Lots going on today, and PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, is back to talk about the insects we're seeing. We'll take a look at monarch butterflies. We'll take a look at, all kinds of things. Fireflies, for sure. I want to talk about Asian longhorn beetles, and I definitely want to talk about Wisconsin Insect Fest, which is coming up August 1st, and we'll get some more details about it as we go along. I see there's one title, one presentation on sex, violence, and deception, the hidden world of wetland insects. I'll get some more details on that a little bit later from PJ. But first, PJ, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
It's great to be here today, Larry.
Let's turn our attention to monarchs first. Monarchs have declined in recent years. I heard there's been a bit of an uptick this year.
Yeah, a bit of an uptick. And it's always hard to gauge monarch numbers, especially this time of the year. And so you can go out in your yard, you can wander around town or just about anywhere in the state, and you maybe are seeing monarchs, maybe you're not. But when you think about the eastern monarch population, they range across essentially the entire eastern half of the country.
Yeah.
And so it's very hard to gauge and kind of estimate and count their numbers this time of the year. So the meter stick, so to speak, that scientists use as we wait for them to migrate down to Mexico. And they go to these mountainous areas outside of Mexico City, and they cram together on these trees, packed very, very densely, thousands of them together on individual trees. And rather than counting the actual butterflies, what scientists do is they basically kind of estimate and measure the area occupied by the overwintering butterflies. And so that's the measuring metric that we use. And so every winter, scientists can do that. Some good news for the current moment is we did see basically a doubling of overwintering area. So their numbers do seem to be up. That's a bit of good news. However, if you look at the amount of area occupied last winter, it was about 1.79 hectares. And a hectare is 2.5 acres. So that's not a huge area when you think about it. All the monarchs from the entire eastern half of the U.S. crammed together into these small areas, like the size of your neighborhood, basically. The average for about the last 10 years was about 2.8 hectares. So we're down from that. And if you were to look at a longer time span, like the last 30 or so years, there's definitely a downward trend.
Yeah.
So there's some concerns out there about monarch populations.
Well, and of course, milkweed's the only plant the monarchs lay their eggs on.
Yeah, that is their food, their host plant. They need those milkweed plants. And there's, of course, various types and species of milkweeds, and they'll go to a range of them. But that's at the heart of their life cycle. And so one very simple thing is if you want to help monarchs, planting more milkweed in your yard, in your neighborhood, maybe if you attend, say, municipal board meetings and things like that, see if you can get your town or city or municipality to get on board with planting milkweed in parks and other areas like that so that we can provide some resources for monarchs.
Yeah, some cities have done a really nice job of that.
They have, yeah, and especially the last decade or so, there's really been this push to plant milkweed. But I will say there are still some municipalities that I've bumped into where they may have some rules on the books regarding noxious weeds that could be decades old. And in some locations, milkweed can be on that list, and you're not supposed to plant it. And so I would hope over time there would be change because that milkweed is so critical for monarchs. And I'll say other insects as well that specifically rely on those plants to go about and complete their life cycle.
Once again, there's some legislation to designate the monarch butterfly as Wisconsin State Butterfly. What do you think of that idea?
I think that's great to hear about, Larry. You know, every state has their own favorite insect or butterfly that they picked. I just feel that the monarch is such a charismatic species. I mean, pretty much everyone is going to love monarch butterflies. And so I think that's great to hear about that. Also, you know, when we recognize the insects like that and their importance, and give them that recognition, you know, then it's easier to buy in and kind of feel, hey, this is our state butterfly, perhaps, and we want to do things to help it out. And so I think that could be a win-win in the long run.
Yeah, I don't know why. Well, there have been a couple of previous attempts, I think, but they failed. The bill failed for a lack of support.
So. Yeah, I've heard about that. I don't know all the details of that process and ins and outs, and sometimes things can move kind of slow, but hopefully this time around that may go through.
You can join in, by the way. If you have an insect question, I hope you will. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. And if you have an insect photo, maybe an ID, we can handle that as well. You can email that in to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear those, see those as well. Fireflies are another insect population I think many people love to see and talk about. And I've seen a lot more this summer, it seems like.
Yeah. You're not alone, Larry. This has been one of the best years I can recall for quite a while for fireflies. Now, fireflies themselves seem to do very well when we have kind of damp conditions. The larvae feed on creatures like slugs. We know slugs like moisture, slugs like damp vegetation, things like that that they feed on. Fireflies love the same habitat. And so when we look back over the last five or so years at our weather patterns, we've had some very dry and droughty periods, and that can be hard on fireflies in a lot of areas. Now, even during dry years, if you were in the right spot, like a creek or river valley mm-hmm. in the driftless region of the state, you could still bump into decent numbers of them. But this year, and really starting last year, we were getting a lot more rains. I think that's helped them out. And so I've been getting a lot of reports of very strong firefly numbers, which is great to see. I mean, those insects are very charismatic. Pretty much everyone grows up seeing fireflies, kind of experiencing the magic of those insects, probably, you know, catching them in an old peanut butter jar or something like that and keeping them as an overnight pet. And so who doesn't love fireflies? Just that that magic behind them is something really neat to see. I will say in my own neighborhood where I live, recently I went down, I'd been telling myself to do this for years, to go down and with my camera and tripod and do some long exposure photography of fire. And it was so much fun. I had to brave the mosquitoes, and I brought a head net with me. So if you have weather that's good for fireflies, fortunately, it's probably also going to be good for mosquitoes, that moisture component. But it does seem to be a good year for fireflies. I will add, though, just like the monarchs, there's concerns about fireflies as a whole. If we look at firefly numbers today, and if you can think back, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, the numbers we have today are likely down compared to in the past due to land use change, pesticide spraying, especially broad spectrum pesticide spraying types that is maybe done for mosquito yard treatments. There's concerns with that and the weather patterns. Dry weather just is not good for fireflies. So there are some concerns out there. If you want to help them out in your own yard, I'd say try to avoid or really limit pesticide use if you can.
Yeah.
And then one other thing, and I know sometimes lighting can add, you know, a lot of character to a yard, the aesthetic component, but they rely on light to find a mate and go about their biology. So light pollution is a concern for them. So leaving some of those lights off, you know, if you're sitting out on your back deck, enjoying a beverage or something, that's fine. But when you're done, turn them off so we're not disrupting those fireflies.
PJ Leash, our guest today, and we'll take some calls now. Mark in Sussex, we'll go to you first. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, and great show as usual.
Thank you.
I was wondering, I have not seen any June bugs in at least southern Wisconsin. I asked a couple people, and nobody's seen any June bugs. I realize it's July, but at least in the southern part, I haven't seen any of the state.
Okay.
Yeah, so they're out there. Again, we are kind of past the period of activity for them. Another name for June bugs is May June beetles. So I was seeing plenty myself in southern Wisconsin during the months of May and June. As we get into later June, July, they basically disappear. You could, in theory, have an occasional rogue sighting here or there. As a whole, though, we have nearly 30 species of June bugs in Wisconsin. And they're not all widely distributed. Some of them are in certain corners of the state and not others. In general, the females like kind of weedy, grassy, turf grass type areas. So a classic place for them would be like fallow farm fields, meadows, places like that. And if you're in a fairly urban suburban area, you may not have great habitat for them. Another component is that with our June bugs in Wisconsin, almost all of them have a three-year life cycle. There's one species, Philophaga tristis, that has a two-year life cycle. Otherwise, they have a three-year life cycle. And what that can mean is in your given spot, you may have a banner crop, so to speak, 1 year, and then things might be relatively quiet the next 2 years. And then in the third year in the cycle, boom, you have a bunch of them again. So there can be a lot of variation, both geographically or spatially, and also over time as well. But definitely some June bugs were out in the state this year, but by now they're basically done with their activity as the adult stage.
There you go, Mark. Thank you so much for calling. Let's take a call from Peter in Appleton. Hi, Peter.
Hi. A couple of weeks ago, my wife and I were down on a beach in Port Washington, and she got bit by what she described as a little tiny red bug, probably not much bigger than a pinhead. But it was very itchy, left a red mark, and a larger red mark, maybe about the size of a dime, formed. That eventually went away, but she still got this spot where the bug bite was. Any idea what that could have been?
Oh, gosh, yeah. I mean, a couple of things come to mind. There are creatures called chiggers, which are technically a small reddish type of mite. They are actually parasites of other animals. They can kind of inadvertently bite humans and cause skin irritation, but usually you wouldn't notice it. Some of our tick species can be reddish. There's always some other oddball possibility. So in my mind, without seeing the actual creature, really hard to pin down exactly what it might have been. Another caveat in a case like this is everybody's skin reacts differently to mosquito bites or black fly bites or this or that. And so there's no good way to be able to just look at a bite or hear a description and figure out a cause in most cases, which makes it a little bit tough.
Peter, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. PJ Leash, our guest today. He has degrees in biological sciences and entomology from the UW-Madison, and he's manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at the world of insects in Wisconsin with our guest, PJ Leash from the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Callers online, so let's go to the phones again, and Scott in Summit Lake. Hi, Scott.
Hi there. You mentioned planting milkweed. Besides throwing them on the ground and having them blow away, how can you get them to grow in a specific spot?
Yeah. Good question. Personally, I have had some challenges with milkweed myself growing it from like young, small transplants. Part of that may be rabbits and other things in yards or squirrels just digging in the area. What I've found a lot of success with in my own yard has been to purchase some plants that are a bit more established in pots and go with those. And then they seem to catch on very quickly. And my impression is once you get those established in the ground, within a year or two, they really start taking off and you get shoots popping up here and there. And then it can almost be more of a matter of selectively, controlling the shoots so that it doesn't take over your entire perennial bed. But if you're having struggles with it, finding a plant nursery near you that has some of our native milkweed plants can be a really good route to go.
I think that's great advice. Scott, there you go. Thank you for calling. Michael in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Michael.
One day old. I'll take it.
Michael, are you there?
Yes, I am. I just wanted to put something out for the listeners of your program that I've naturalized my yard for the last 20 years. I haven't mown. And now I kind of live in the woods and I have all kinds of insects and all kinds of other critters, and it does a lot for the environment. It does a lot for insects, and also I don't have to use fossil fuels to mow the lawn, create pollution, And there's a lot more of that now than there was, say, even 20 years ago. I live in Madison, and as I'm driving around today, there are a lot of naturalized yards, and it does an awful lot for the community. And so I want to thank you for the program, and I hope the listeners take this to heart because it's a great thing to do.
Yeah, thank you, Michael.
Yeah, and I feel there can be a lot of benefits to that that approach. So I really think it's great to hear that. We have so many insects that rely on plants for part of their life cycle. They may be herbivores feeding directly on plants, or if they're, say, predators or parasites, they may be targeting some of the insects on those plants. So in general, the more plants you have in your yard and the more plant diversity, that's going to help out a wider range of insects. As the caller, Michael, mentioned, you know, there can be other benefits, too. If you don't have that traditional turf grass lawn and you don't have to mow it, well, you have more time because you don't have to go out mm-hmm. and mow. And this time of the year, it seems to be once, twice a week almost. Mm-hmm. And there can all around be a lot of benefits. I think this idea is really getting some traction. I know other states like Minnesota, there's a program to encourage folks to establish bee lawns, which have wildflowers incorporated, a lot less mowing and things like that. And as I said, there can be a lot of win-win benefits from situations like that.
Let's go to Jim in rural Wausau next. Hi, Jim.
Hi. We have a serious problem with Japanese beetles this year. It's the worst I've ever seen. And they have just about decimated all my grapevines. And I've tried several insecticides on them, and they just seem to like it. So I was wondering, is there maybe the best insecticide to control them on the grapevines?
Yeah, they love grapevines.
They do. I mean, Japanese beetles feed on over 300 different types of plants. And if you made a gigantic list, grapevines would probably be up in about the top five or top 10 for sure. Jim, what have you sprayed at this point? I'm curious.
I tried Dead Bug, which is a BT spray to start with. And then I tried a Bear product, a Cytruthen, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking maybe 7 would work.
Okay. Yeah, so the Dead Bug Brew, which is Captain Jack's Dead Bug Brew is the name of the product, that contains the ingredient spinosad, which generally doesn't seem to work very well against Japanese beetles. It seems to do an okay job with other beetles, but just seems to struggle with Japanese beetles. So not too surprising there. For the other products you mentioned, the beta-cyfluthrin and the newer formulation of 7 for the last, gosh, 5-8 years or so. It used to contain carbaryl. Now it contains one of the pyrethroid ingredients, which is the same class as the cyfluthrin I just mentioned. That will generally work. You have to understand the limitations, though. It only is going to work for about a week or two. So you may have to apply, observe, see if the beetle pressure is still high, spray again. Also, grapevines, if they are growing rapidly, they're putting out new leaves all the time, and you're only protecting the leaves that you sprayed. And so if you spray today and over the next week or so, you have new leaves pop out, those new tender leaves that are very succulent and attractive to the Japanese beetles, they have not been sprayed, and so they are not protected. And so that could be playing a role in the management here. One other thing to consider is that grapes and a lot of other plants, they're surprisingly resilient. If you go to a commercial vineyard, they are pruning leaves off all the time, and those plants just chug along. So the point I want to make is those plants can actually withstand quite a bit of feeding damage from Japanese beetles, like 20, 30% defoliation before your yields, i.e. the number of grapes, the size of the grape clusters and things like that, really seems to take a hit. And so keep that in mind. You don't need to be out there with the approach of trying to eradicate every Japanese beetle. I take much more of the approach of let's limit the damage, kind of slow it down a bit so that those plants can be protected. You still get your yields. Now, depending on how big your grape patch is, one thing you could try if it's not very big, if you can track down some fine mesh netting and physically cover the top of the plants, that would act as a physical barrier so that they cannot get to and feed on the leaves. Now, if you've got a long stretch of grapes, that's not going to be an option, but smaller vineyard patch, that could work.
Yeah, it could indeed. Jim, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Just on the opposite end, Richard in Norwalk sent an email to ask if Japanese beetle populations rise and fall. Richard says he hasn't seen very many near them when he used to see a lot of them in Norwalk.
Yeah, so it's been interesting because Japanese beetles are an insect that I have been studying and working with for close to two decades at this point. Years ago, as a graduate student and a researcher on campus, I did a lot of hands-on experiments. If you go back, say, about 15 years ago in Madison, for example, you could drive by our mall on the west side and identify linden trees from about a mile away because they have that, yeah, that conical shape. Every leaf was skeletonized. The trees were brown. And now I see some around, not very bad, though. So there can be some natural kind of ebbing and flowing of populations. In general, for the last five or so years, what I've seen is that in many parts of southern Wisconsin, and there's variability, but many parts of southern Wisconsin, their numbers have gone down quite a bit compared to 10, 15, 20 years ago. So that's good news. When you get up to Highway 29, that Wausau area, like our last caller, on up, that's where we're seeing the bigger numbers these days.
Yeah, I think I've seen two Japanese beetles this year, and that's it.
Yeah. Yeah, so they're out there, but in some spots, not too bad, whereas in other areas, if you haven't bumped into them before and you're in Wausau or Merrill or Eau Claire or Green Bay, they can be pretty bad out there at the moment.
Tim in La Crosse, we'll go to you now. Hi, Tim.
Hi there. I've got ants coming into my kitchen. They're very small. I suspect they're probably in the wall behind the kitchen sink. I think there may be feral ants from what I can tell, and I'm just wondering what can I do to get rid of them.
Yeah, a little bit tough, especially if you're seeing some small ants. And the first thing I would mention was if you haven't done any spraying yet, don't start. Hold off on that. We do have certain ants, like farrow ant, that if you spray, they can do something weird where you have your ant colony and it basically splits into two. And now you're chasing two fires to put out instead of one. So the first step I would say is we should figure out exactly which ant you're dealing with because each ant can be managed a little bit differently. If we can figure out the ant species, and by all means, I'd encourage you to collect some of the ants in maybe a small container, send them into me at the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. And that way I can look at them under the microscope, let you know exactly what they're. And then we can fine tune our management approaches. In many situations, we can maybe use a bait. Again, depending on the ant species, sprays may or may not be a good option. But until we know the ant species, it's a little hard to provide some good, reliable management advice.
And there's instructions on, if you type in UW Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, you'll get some information there on where to send and so forth. And with a really small ant like that, sometimes you get photos.
I do, yeah. And larger ants, I can sometimes pick out from photos. If it's a really tiny ant, we're talking like under a tenth of an inch long, a 16th of an inch. It's just hard. I mean, for really small ants, there's two species that very difficult to tell apart from photos, the farrow ant and the thief ant. The thief ant, I've had some recent cases. That one's also sometimes called the grease ant. They love kind of fatty type foods. And so one thing you could try is if you cut out like a little piece of wax paper and try putting on one like a dab of peanut butter, on another one a little drop of cooking oil, see if they go to that. That could be something you could try. And if they do like that, you could go to the hardware store and pick out an ant bait that says on the packaging that it's for like fat or protein-loving ants and try that.
Let's take another call. Scotty in Manitowoc, thank you for calling. Scotty, are you there? Well, let's take a call from Tom in Green Bay then. Hi, Tom.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Well, one question. How many different kinds of mosquitoes do we have in Wisconsin? First of all.
Okay, and then.
Second question is a comment that if you turn off all your lights outside, you know, make sure your windows are dark, you got a whole lot less spider webs under your soffit, let me tell you.
Okay.
So for the first question, mosquito species in the state, it's right around 56 mosquito species. And some of these can be very common and widespread. Some of them are restricted to specific habitats. Like one of my favorite mosquito species is actually the pitcher plant mosquito, and it develops inside pitcher plants and bogs up north. Doesn't bite humans. And so it's just kind of this quirky, interesting species. Other ones are widespread and can really kind of ruin picnics and outdoor activities. Regarding the lights, that is a really great point. I mean, we said lights can interfere with things like fireflies, other nocturnal insects like moths and other things that are out after dark. But also, spiders catch on. If we have lights on and that is drawing insects in, spiders can set up shop right next to that light because they get an easy meal. And so if the lights are off, you're not attracting insects. That may help you decrease spiders around your house as well.
James emailed to say they live on the Baraboo River where they discovered the giant stonefly, an insect they'd never known before, and wondered if you what you could tell us about giant stoneflies.
Yeah, so giant stoneflies, I don't see that often. And if you haven't seen these, they're good-sized insects, maybe about an inch and a half long. They're kind of dark-colored, grayish, brownish-blackish, but they'll have some orange on the body, especially kind of the pronotum or neck region, if you will. Look almost a little bit prehistoric, if you will, just with the sheer size. They develop in clean, fast-moving bodies of water. So you have a river there. I used to bump into these around Memorial Day weekend. I would often go up with friends and whitewater raft on the Wolf River north of Shawnee, which was always a fun trip. And we'd be going down the river and sometimes see those. So I always have fond memories when I see these insects. It takes me back to the whitewater rafting trips. But they can serve as a general indicator of good water quality. If you have really polluted rivers and streams, they're just not going to do well in those habitats. So that can be a good thing about seeing them, as it tells you you've got some decent water quality near you.
Yeah, and you know what? Louis in La Crosse has something that kind of relates to all this. Let's go there. Louis, hi.
Hi, yeah, thank you for taking my call. I have a question about mayflies. So I grew up in La Crosse, and my family has a cabin on the Mississippi River, and I was always told as a kid, big mayfly hatches are a good indicator of a healthy river. I'm just curious, what are some of the factors that play into what a healthy river is that makes a mayfly hatch so massive?
Yeah, so a couple of things that come to mind when I think about, you know, water quality. You could have pollutants that could be from man-made activities, you know, petroleum-based products and things like that getting into river. You could also have situations where if you have, say, agricultural runoff and that gets into the water and that leads to algal blooms and things like that, that can impact water quality. That could impact oxygen concentration in the water potentially. We have all these aquatic insects, and some of them have very high oxygen demands. And for water, generally, the colder the water, you can have more oxygen. So think of like nice, clean, cold trout streams. You have certain insects there that aren't going to do well in big polluted rivers. And so, again, there's a lot of factors that can influence that. But we do know certain insects can do okay in kind of dirtier water. Some of them really need cleaner water. And there was an entomologist here on campus back in the 1990s, Dr. Bill Hilsenhoff, who was an aquatic entomologist. And he actually really sat down and looked at all these factors and came up with what's called the Hilsenhoff Biotic Index, where you could be a biologist, go out and survey the insects that are present and use that information to basically gauge water quality, which is really cool when you think about it.
Yeah, very, very cool. Louis, thank you so much for calling. Robert in Amherst Junction, what's on your mind?
Hi there. Thank you. I met my wife rafting, whitewater rafting on the Wolf River.
Cool.
So I actually had two questions, one about apple trees, but the other is about these lights that people put out. And canoeing down the river, I'm just noticing all these houses along the river, and they've got these bug zappers. And I know that what they want to do is they want to kill insects they don't like. But Do those bug zappers attract biting insects, or do they just attract harmless insects?
Yeah, so answer to that is basically both. You will draw in some biting insects like mosquitoes. Mosquito researchers do have traps that are somewhat similar, but they're designed to be much more specific to mosquitoes versus the larger kind of bug zappers. You get some mosquitoes, but mostly you're going to be attracting and zapping and killing other kind of incidental things, moths, various flies, and things like that. So there's a lot of kind of bycatch, if you will, or non-target impacts from those zappers. And from what I've seen in the literature, they're probably not really helping with mosquito numbers or mosquito bites that you're experiencing, and they're probably doing more harm than good.
Yeah. You had another question, I believe, Robert?
Yeah, you know, so one of the things that is recommended or that you read about with apple trees and particularly apple maggot fly is to put out little round discs with tanglefoot on them. But that is a really labor-intensive and messy process. And I'm just wondering, I mean, I've also heard that that's only a way to monitor the numbers, not really to impact the population.
Yeah, it depends a little bit on context. So you can buy what are called red sphere traps, and it's basically like a plastic ball or sphere, and you cover it with tanglefoot, which if you haven't worked with, it's just these
horribly sticky
stuff. So you basically have this big red sticky ball. You hang it in the canopy of the trees. Depends on the context, so in terms of monitoring versus control. So if you have, say, a large orchard, you're not going to be able to get control with that. But you could put out those traps. That could alert you. If you keep an eye on them, you'd say, oh, gosh, apple maggot is now active, so I'm going to implement some other management approaches. If you have a tree, apple tree, or maybe just a couple trees in your yard, and you put out a bunch of these, as you mentioned, it is kind of labor intensive, but if you have relatively large numbers, and that might be 3, 4, 5 of these per apple tree, that can actually provide some control in that context. So you have to look at how many trees you have and kind of that ratio of these traps to the trees.
Robert, thank you very much for calling. And on to Scotty in Manitowoc. Hi, Scotty.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I raise monarch butterflies in a little three little tents in my house. I get the eggs from my garden. I have, butterfly weed and various kinds of milkweed. And this year I have an abundance of butterfly eggs, and I'm afraid my population may be a bit larger than the one swamp plant, milkweed plant that I have. Will they eat other milkweed plants, or do I have to stick with exactly the type of plant that I find the caterpillar on? Will a caterpillar from a swamp milkweed also eat butterfly weed?
Yeah, good question. I suspect that they would. So you can certainly try that, especially if you're getting low on the one type of milkweed that they had been started on. One challenge, though, with caterpillars and kind of what you're getting at with the question is sometimes if you start them on one plant and you switch them to something else, they may not like that. Now, when I think of that sort of situation, I'm thinking more of species that can feed on a wide range of trees. And so if you start them feeding on apple and you switch to something very different, like maple trees, they may not like that. I would suspect, though, in this case, if you tried just two different milkweed species, they may go for that second one because those milkweeds are very closely related.
Scotty, good luck with that. Thank you very much for calling. PJ Leash, our guest today, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Coming up at noon, we'll be talking about the diversity and complexity of bird calls with a UW-Madison researcher, and we'll have a few calls for you to listen to as well as we talk with the researcher. So looking forward to that. Right now, The World of Insects with P.J. Leash. And P.J., before we get away from time here, I wanted to mention the Wisconsin Insect Fest, which is August 1st this year. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so I'm really excited about this, Larry. This is an event that the UW-Madison Entomology Department has been hosting for about 5 or so years at this point, and we've moved it around to various locations in the state. This year, I'm very pleased to announce we are partnering with Olbrich Botanical Gardens here in Madison, Wisconsin, on the east side of town. And the event is Friday, August 1st in the afternoon from 1 until 6 p.m., This is a free, family-friendly event. We've got some activities suitable for kids all the way up to grown-ups. We've got a number of insect booths, about a dozen or so booths with various activities and outreach-type things. But we've got a great lineup of speakers for talks, guided walks outdoors, and a bunch of other fun stuff. The talks are going to range from everything from a workshop on insect photography with someone who's just a spectacular photographer, Kevin Hanley. We've got seminars on natural history of fireflies, bog creatures, bog insects, one of my favorite topics, wild solitary bees and things like that. I'm going to be talking about cicadas as well. I will say this is a free event, but space is limited. And so if you head to the website for Olbrich Botanical Gardens and look for events on August 1st, you'll find a page with sign up for it. Or we have a page on the UW Entomology website. You can go to the URL go.wisc.edu/insectfest. And there's RSVP buttons. You can just click that. It's free to reserve your seats because we got limited space. But again, this is going to be Friday, August 1st, Wisconsin Insect Fest at Olbrich Botanical Gardens here in Madison. And I'm really hoping to have a lot of you turn up to check out some fun insect activities.
Yeah, and come early and take a walk through Olbrich because it's a beautiful time of the year to be there.
It is. And actually, that entire day at Olbrich, there's other insect activities going on. There's an event called Butterfly Action Day about butterfly conservation. So there's booths for that. There's also a blooming butterflies exhibit where you can pay a little bit and go in and experience live butterflies, which is really cool. So you could come spend the entire day at Olbrich and just have a spectacular time learning about and experiencing insects.
Yeah, it's very cool. And I'm a member over there, so I can get into those for free.
Nice.
Oh, boy. Well, I hope you get a big turnout, and I'm sure you will. It's going to be a lot of fun, for sure. Stephanie in Madison has something relating to monarchs, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, Larry. Hi, PJ. Thanks for the show.
Sure.
I used to also raise monarch caterpillars indoors, and I was kind of doing some research because I was concerned if this is, you know, an okay practice or if there's any concerns of like the viability of the butterflies after raising them indoors. I've heard maybe like they aren't able to migrate as well. And I was curious if you have any thoughts about raising monarchs. I know you can have like a setup outdoors, you can have a setup indoors. I'm curious if you have any insights into that.
Yeah, I really appreciate that question. And personally, I have some very mixed feelings about raising monarchs. As you mentioned, there can be some concerns. One thing that comes to mind is if we are using the same cage or enclosure to raise a whole bunch of caterpillars, the monarch caterpillars can become infected with various pathogens. And so if they are all together in the same cage, sharing some of the same food, it's possible that they could be spreading diseases to one another. And you may not know it, but if the adult that emerges is weakened and it can't make it to Mexico, you know, that could be a concern. We also have some data from published studies about raising them indoors. And basically, they get a little out of sync with the natural cycles, the movement of the sun and things like that. And that might impact their ability to navigate. So that would be a concern, especially later in the summer when you have that generation that is going to be migrating down to Mexico in the fall. And so, again, very mixed feelings about this. On one hand, though, raising monarchs can be a really neat and great experience, educational-wise. It's a way to get children and adults, for that matter, really interested, and they can take a close look at that life cycle. So there's definitely some educational benefit. My own thoughts about this is if you want to raise small numbers of them indoors for educational purposes, to show family members and friends, that's great. There can be a lot of benefit to that. But if you are trying to raise large numbers of them indoors, if you aren't doing it quite right, there definitely can be some concerns for the health of the butterflies and also their ability to navigate.
Yeah. Stephanie, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Bridget in La Crosse had emailed us, and you were saying that you were going to be talking about cicadas, and she has a question relating to cicadas. Their birthday mid-July, all their life they've heard of the cicadas calling, knew the birthday was coming, and Bridget's wondering if the 12-plus inches of rain we had in late June had an impact. They've seen plenty of monarchs and a very good number of fireflies. Are the annual cicadas just late for the first time ever?
Yeah, good question. I mean, one thing I had been looking at, and I do this every year, but I'll keep a close eye on what we call growing degree days. It's a way to basically gauge how much heat we have accumulated over the course of the growing season. If you go back a month or so ago before that heat wave we had in June, we were a little bit behind average. Now, I think we've certainly caught up a bit more. But sometimes there can be some local factors if you are in a valley or something like that, and it's just a little bit cooler for that local microclimate. That could perhaps delay things. So it's very possible that they might just be delayed a little bit in your given area. I will say here in the Madison area, I've heard of a lot of cicadas buzzing from trees. I know the eastern cicada killer wasps are out, and that's a wasp that specifically hunts cicadas and is synced up pretty well time-wise. So they're out in other parts of the state. I would have a suspicion they might not be out just quite yet, but probably will be very soon in your area. I do wonder about the rain, though. In terms of a very heavy rain, if you had some soils that were waterlogged for long periods of time, that could potentially be bad for insects because cicadas spend their life cycle mostly below ground, feeding on tree roots. And so if they were submerged in saturated soil for a long time, that probably would be hard on them as well.
Angela in Bailey's Harbor emailed to ask if earwigs on their milkweed are a serious threat to monarch caterpillars and eggs. Angela doesn't normally spray for any insects, but wondering if some homemade traps would be beneficial. Said they also read about insects, specifically bees, getting stuck in the milkweed and dying. Can you elaborate on any of this? Angela wonders. And she shared a couple of photos of monarch caterpillars.
Nice. Yeah, we've got some great photos up here in the studio at the moment. In terms of the earwigs have interesting habits. They are omnivores. So you can go out after dark and sometimes see earwigs feeding on plants in your yard. I was out just a night or two ago and saw this in my own garden. They also can be scavengers and even predators at time to a certain extent. And so there's a possibility if you had just a lot of earwigs on and around your milkweed plants, I can't rule out the possibility that they might try to feed on those eggs. One very simple thing you could do, well, two things actually come to mind. You could try some of the traps. You can make your own with like a little empty tuna can and things like that on the ground. You could put down an old shingle or something, give them a hiding spot during the daytime, flip that over and squish them or something like that. But they're often pretty easy to knock off of plants. And so if you see them on leaves, especially after dark, you could take a container of soapy water, knock them down into that. If you feel that it's warranted. In terms of the stickiness, milkweeds actually have some interesting pollen and floral structures. And I've seen pictures where something like a honeybee has gone to a milkweed flower for nectar and pollen, and they get some of these structures stuck to them. And often you get kind of this chain of floral parts stuck yeah. to their leg. So there is that definitely that sticky component there as well.
I wanted to be sure to mention Asian longhorn beetles because the DNR is asking people to keep an eye out for them, and they're kind of easy to spot.
Yeah, they are. So if you haven't heard of the Asian longhorn beetle before, just do an internet search for that. They're very large, distinctive members of the longhorned beetle family Cerambycidae. They're big. They're like close to an inch and a half long or so, jet black with kind of the starry night pattern. It's a pretty insect.
White spots.
To look at. Yeah, white spots, white bands on the antennae. They are a concern because they're an invasive species. They can attack a wide range of trees, especially maples they seem to like, but other hardwood trees as well. There are some issues with them in the eastern U.S., so it's definitely something we want to be aware of. Am I expecting it to show up in the state this year? No, not necessarily. And actually, if you look at the Midwest historically, Chicago at one point had an issue with these, and folks there were able to eradicate Asian longhorn beetle from Chicago. So this does seem to be an insect that with enough effort, you can fight back against it compared to something like emerald ash borer, a lot harder to do. So that's some good news about it. But still, with insects like this, if they're invasive, we ideally want to catch them early to give us the best shot at eradicating them from our area. And this could have impacts on forested areas, but also urban forest as well.
So if you see one, what do you do?
Yeah, best thing to do in a case like this, I mean, you could certainly email me photos if you want so we can look at it. Otherwise, I would try to collect the specimen if you can. And also reach out to Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade and Consumer Protection, or DATCAP, as we call them. They actually have a pest hotline where you can call and call in with reports of suspected invasive species, and then someone will follow up, and that might include a site visit if there's a suspicion of species like Asian longhorn beetle.
Let's go back to the Insect Fest for just a minute. Wisconsin Insect Fest on August 1st. That's at Olbrich Park. Are you a good photographer? There's insects?
I'd say decent. I've got a pretty good setup in my lab, macro photography lens, so I like to think I'm decent, but I know there's some folks that are a lot better photographers than I am, and we do have Kevin Hanley, who's a master naturalist, and he's going to be leading a workshop, so I'm very excited about that activity.
And again, go through the, it's August 1st, and it's in the afternoon, right?
Yep, 1 to 6 p.m., and if you want to find information about that, head to the Olbrich Garden website, or look up the UW Entomology website, or a short link for that is go.wisc.edu/insectfest.
I love the title of the one's talk, Sex, Violence, and Deception, The Hidden World of Wetland Insects.
Wow. Should be a fun time. All sorts of interesting creatures live in bogs. You have interesting carnivorous plants. You have all sorts of insects that rely on these various plants that are restricted to that very specific habitat. And it's a world that most folks never experience, because how many folks get their feet wet and wander out into bogs to take a close look?
Yeah, that's going to be a fun talk. And again, you do need to sign up.
Yes.
Because there is limited space.
Yes. Yeah. The
it's free, but you got to sign up.
Yep. Exactly. So if you head to the website pages for it, there's free RSVP links. You can click those buttons and be able to reserve seats for yourself or your family. But again, space is limited, so don't delay.
Well, that's going to be a whole lot of fun, PJ, and I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I think we covered all of our questions, and there's one more. We can do this quickly, maybe. Marcia emailed to ask about morning glories. This year, they're noticing skeletonized. Would insects be involved in that?
Most likely, yes. Morning glories, skeletonization type damage. I would wonder about Japanese beetles. So keep an eye out during the daytime. If you don't see anything during the day, including taking a close look at topside, underside of leaves, I would suggest heading out after dark with a flashlight or headlamp and do some checking. Then sometimes there's insects that are primarily active at nighttime.
Thank you so much, PJ. PJ Leash, director of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and we will have him back, and we will do this all over again. Coming up, we're going to talk about bird calls, bird songs. There's been some great and interesting research on it. We'll learn about it next. I'm Larry Mueller. To have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, I think one of the joys in life for me is to be outside, and especially when there's no traffic and I'm in a woods or I'm just walking through my neighborhood early in the morning, as I do most mornings, and hearing the birds' songs. And there's such a variety of songs that I hear and I enjoy, and I bet you enjoy hearing those songs as well. There's been some really cool research done on bird calls, bird songs, and really bird songs that are heard around the world. And one of the people who's done that work is Sathya Chandra Sagar. Sagra.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I got that wrong. Sagra. Oh, my goodness. I even practiced that beforehand, and I still got it wrong.
No, you didn't. That's perfect. It's quite a long name. So.
Well, I tell you what, Sathya, it's a pleasure to have you with us. Sathya is a conservation scientist. He's a field ornithologist and a recent PhD graduate from the UW-Madison's Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, and is the lead author on this fascinating global study of bird songs. And I hope you'll join in. We'll hear a few bird songs along the way, but if you have a question or comment, I hope you'll join in. Number's 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. Welcome to the show, Sathya. How did you get interested in birds and bird songs?
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Larry. Yeah, this is a pleasure to be here. And yeah, similar to you, I've always loved birds, and my introduction to ecology and conservation and, you know, my life itself as a scientist dates back to the time when I listened to birds. And I was always fascinated by them. And finally, after, you know, nearly 26 years, I think I got this opportunity to kind of use, science to look at, you know, why bird calls, or why does it sing a certain way, and how can that be used, you know, in conservation of theirs. So, yeah, that's how it started.
And it's a really interesting idea. And this is a remarkable, I think, global study.
Yeah.
How the heck were you running all over the world capturing bird songs? I don't think so.
No, definitely not. No, this study that we conducted, I was the lead author, as you said, but also this was a collaborative effort between people like Anna Pigeon, Maya Pershey, Akash, Ben, they were all from, UW-Madison, and Chan from Utah, and my advisor, Zuzana Burivalova. And none of us went around the world collecting all the bird songs. But in fact, we used a fantastic, data set that is actually collected by the community scientists, or, previously called as citizen scientists, who are just birders and who are not professional ornithologists, but probably better birders than many scientists, and went out and collected data for nearly 8,000 or 9,000 species of birds all over the world. And it's freely available in an online platform called Xenocanto. And that's the only reason why I was able to do such very global research.
So Xenocanto is, I guess you'd call it a bird watching repository.
Yes, it's like a bird, like a bird recording repository, I would say. Yes. You know, people collect information on their calls and songs and then put it there. And then there are volunteers who go through these songs to see if what, to create them about you know, what quality it is in, and A being the highest and DE being not the best. And yeah, and it's out there for people to use it and listen to it and enjoy. And like me also, with enjoying studying them. Yeah.
So why do birds call?
I mean, for a variety of reasons, I guess. I mean, you know, there is research has gone to say why do they call and want to make territory, saying that this is my place, you know. So I'm here and to show their presence to another males to say that don't come into my territory, and also to show to the females saying that, well, I'm here and look it out and check it out. But also sometimes I think philosophically they just do it because they love. Also, I think because, you know, the way we sing sometimes and we talk to the world, and I think there's also an aspect of that.
I agree with you. I mean, I sometimes observe birds singing, and to me it looks like they're just for the joy of it.
Yeah, they're having fun. Yeah, that's true.
So why is it important to study?
We knew that, you know, birds are singing, and there's a whole field of bioacoustics, which is basically trying to use the sounds of the nature to study either the landscape or the forests, and the group I was part of, Zuzana Burivalova's Sound Forest Lab, uses bioacoustics, where we collect the sounds of the forest or collect the sounds of the landscape, to know whether it's healthy or not, to conserve it, to understand it. And bird songs are a big part of this soundscape per se, which is like all the sounds in a landscape, right? But while we knew that, you know, like sounds of birds is a big part of the soundscape, but we didn't really know what are those traits that underlie the wide variability. Like, why can't all the birds sing at the same frequency, for example? Like, why should they have different frequencies? And what are those evolutionary factors and ecological factors that shape this frequency differences and this diversity that birds have? And then, you know, so before I used these bioacoustic tools to study how good the forest is, I wanted to study why they are like that, so that I can use it in the conservation of the forest. So that was my first goal. And
you talk about frequency character. I've read some of your writing on that. You talk about frequency characteristics.
Yes. Yes.
So what does that actually mean? Describe what that means.
Yeah, well, frequency characteristics, here we use something like a minimum frequency. Like, you know, if a bird sings, it always has a range of frequencies. You know, many of the species have multiple songs or, you know, a range of frequencies. So we used some of the chosen ones, like the minimum frequency, the lowest of the frequency, maximum frequency, which is like the highest, and the dominant frequency, where there's a lot of frequency characters, frequency energy. And then we also looked at the range, you know, like the difference in the minimum to maximum, how wide that is, basically to look at do they have a huge range, for example? Mm-hmm. So these are the characteristics that we analyzed.
It's interesting. I mean, I think today a lot of this type of research, I'm not sure how precise or possible it could have been maybe 30 years ago. I mean, the equipment that we have, what you were using, some pretty sophisticated sound equipment, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so I think there's two aspects of it. One is the sound equipment that was used by the recorders, like the people out there recording. And that has, you know, like developed quite a bit. I mean, the reason why we're having such clarity of voice, like yours and mine, being, you know, recorded right now. And at the same time, I think the computational power with computers and analysis that we can do with these have just been amazing. So I think there's been no better time where we can use this amazing naturalistic data set that collected by these people with the computational power to understand these global patterns.
So all these 8,000 species, I'm thinking of just how difficult it must have been, or how did you go about separating out this of all of these species, or did you zero in on just some of the 8,000, or was all of the 8,000?
No, it was, I mean, there are about 11,500, you know, odd species, and we focused only on about 8,900 because we could not get the, and so we did focus on 8,900. It was a 77% of species. But also, we were not just randomly looking into, you know, what we can find from the data, but we had a specific hypothesis that we wanted to test, because I'm not the first person who has tried to, you know, disentangle this. So, you know, for over a century, people have been wondering, like, what is the relationship between how big of a bird is and their call, and does the beak size affect the calls, and whether there's a difference in call frequency characteristic between tropics and temperate regions. You know, so many of these things people have pondered over the years. So I want to kind of try to get an answer for that.
Well, Surya, did you find any find birds making sounds in surprising ways, or ways that were surprising to you at least?
Well, yes, there was like surprising, you know, kind of results. But and some of the things that I already hypothesized, you know, for example, one of the things was we were thinking, well, you know, a bird will, like a large bird, will always call in a lower frequency is what we had assumed. And after looking at 8,000 species, we found that, yes, they do. That if, you know, there's a strong relationship between body size and the call frequency. And at the same time, we also found that there's something called, acoustic size exaggeration is when like a smaller bird wants to show off, saying that it's quite larger than it is. So it makes an effort to reduce its call frequency so that other individuals or other species that are listening to it will realize, oh, okay, that must be a really large bird. So that acoustic size exaggeration was found by a few species before. But then now with this large data set, we realize that, well, there is a lot of evidence for this to be shown across the board of species. And that was quite fascinating. So to see that.
Sathya Chandra Sagara, our guest today, and we're talking with him about his research, along with some other people, of bird songs and bird talk, I guess you could say it in a way. 8,000 species of birds they've analyzed, and they've got some really fascinating results. We'll hear some of those sounds coming up, and also I want to look at the takeaways eventually from all of the research, because I think that is really fascinating to me. You can join in, question, comment, give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. We're looking into some research that has been done on, well, actually a global study of bird songs that help us explain the reasons why these sounds are made. And our guest today was the leader, certainly the leader of the research on it, Sathya Chandra Sagara, our guest today, and I'm having some fun listening to him. I hope you are as well. Michael emailed to ask about birds that mimic other birds that mimic the sounds of machinery, like the superb
lyrebird.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there are a lot of species that do mimic, and they are fantastic. And I know, like, so there are species that mimic other bird songs. There are species that mimic, as you said, you know, machinery and fire. And I think it all happens in their repertoire itself. You know, like it becomes part of who those species are. Not all of them can mimic, and some can, and some do. And that, you know. However, like, I was also fascinated by these birds because they can mimic, but at the same time, they can't mimic, you know, super high variability, for example. You know, these lyrebirds might not be able to do a frequency as low as, for example, an ostrich. You know, it's like super low frequency, or a very high frequency like some of the hummingbirds that we have. So. But yeah, they do
within their range.
Yes, but some birds do push the limit of range, and what we have done in our study is not look into like species by species, but more of a general pattern across the world. So there is quite a bit of variation, you know, when we look at this pattern. So it would not be wrong to say that that lyrebirds do fall into that category of they are specialty. You know, like we know that birds tend to have a certain range, but these might have a huge range. Yeah.
Colleen emailed to ask why robins seem to have a song for when it's raining. That's interesting. I hadn't noticed that.
Well, I guess I mean they do sing when it's raining or not raining, and I'm not very sure whether they have a special song while during singing, but possibly they do, and I'm not very sure. Sorry about that. But I'm definitely possibly something a really amazing research project to look into in the future. Yeah.
Well, habitat, you did kind of, in a way, study habitat. And how can habitat influence the calls that birds make?
Yeah. So the initial hypothesis that we wanted to test was something called acoustic adaptation hypothesis, meaning, there's been these theories that, the density of a landscape where a species is, will that kind of force the species to have a certain kind of frequency? Like a very dense habitat, a species might want to have a low frequency or a high frequency or something like that. And we wanted to test that relationship. But what we found was the vegetation density is not a big factor. However, what we found out that irrespective of the vegetation density, just the habitat itself does make a big difference. One of the things that we saw was, for example, species that are associated with riverine habitats, like stream gorgers or right next to streams, they tend to have a really high frequency, and it makes sense. For example, you are walking in a woodland, for example, in the Baraboo Hills, and you're going closer to the stream gorge, and that's where you'll tend to hear like really high frequency species like winter wren, for example. And this is because the ambient sounds, like the streams, have a very low frequency sound, like the ambient noise itself. So these species want to stand out. They don't want to talk amongst each other with the same frequency. So they want to be loud and say, well, I'm still here despite the background sound. So in a way, that does make a big difference.
I bet Lee's got a winter wren song. Have you got the...
Yeah,
that's a different frequency.
Yeah, it's just amazing frequency. Yeah.
Compared to like a rushing water.
Yep. Yeah. Compared to definitely. Because if it's a rushing water and a species has the same frequency, then it's just.
It's not going to be heard.
It's not going to be heard. No, definitely not. So I think, So maybe the question from Colleen, I think, saying that. So the rain does have an ambient sound, it does have a rustling sound. It does have a thundering sound that kind of muffles the sound at the back. And robin, if it wants to show off and I'm still here and I can still change my voice modulation, it might change its frequency. And birds tend to do that. They can change their, they can use it at a higher frequency within their range. But they can tend to use their higher frequency call notes or low frequency call notes in their repertoire to show off, saying that, well, it's raining, but I'm still here.
I'm still here. That's a really good point. Willem in Colfax has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Willem.
Hi. I always look forward to in the spring when the return of we have a brown thrasher that always returns to the same oak tree, it seems like. And they make such a long string of calls that I think are in the, I think they might be mockingbirds in the group. And it goes on and on, and it's so beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. I mean, they are fantastic. I mean, brown thrashers have an amazing repertoire of calls and songs, and certainly one of the best here in the temperate regions.
We might even have a brown.
Yeah, beautiful.
Yeah, beautiful. There you go, Willem. You got to hear them again.
Yep.
Thank you
very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Ed in central Wisconsin called but couldn't stay with us. But Ed said they used to hear more frequently whippoorwills. And are those birds on the decline? And I believe they are.
Yeah, and I think this brings to this whole topic of, like, you know, conservation, the threats that these birds are facing. Is, I think for me, there are the two different things. Like, for example, like a person who just texted, and I think it, you know, you're not just connected to the landscape just through the forest of just the stones and the grasslands, but also through the sounds of the landscape. You know, when you lose a whippoorwill, you also lose the whippoorwill song. And that means that there's a big part of you, your presence there also is lost due to the loss of that species. And this is happening all over the world. I mean, whippoorwill's population is going down because of the habitat loss that they depend on. And the same thing we hear reverberate all over the world. I mean, sometimes in really good forests, we are also losing these amazing species because they sing well. Like, for example, in Southeast Asia, I mean, I'm giving examples of all over the world because of the global study, that in Southeast Asia, you know, already species are losing their habitat. And what's left of the habitat where the species have to be present, we are losing these, you know, beautiful songbirds because of pet trade. The people there love the bird songs, like the callers today, so much that they want to keep the birds as pets, wild birds as pets in cages. And so you have this double problem for these species. You're losing the habitat, and also the forest are empty and silent. It's very eerie, because when I was there studying bird songs in the landscape and how that pet trade is affecting them, there was nothing. It was silent in many places, you know. So it's so nice to come, you know, come here and go to a forest and at least see, hear a brown thrasher, for example, or a winter wren. Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking about this too. If you if there's an area that has always had certain types of birds residing there, and suddenly you're not hearing those anymore. I mean, habitat may be the issue, but it could be something else too.
Yep, that is true. And that's exactly, you know, how bioacoustics, like, you know, is used to study a problem. I mean, you know, it's like just like us, you know, if you're in a house and if you're hearing your mom or dad talk, or your, you know, sister or brother, you know that they're present. But if they're not speaking or talking, then they're not there, that something is wrong. I mean, they have gone out, for example, or, you know, they're just not present. So it's the same for a habitat. You know, when you listen to them, if the species that were there all the time are lost, if the habitat is lost, yes, that's one reason. But also climate change right now is a big, big issue. The habitat could be same, you know, it's changing slowly, but species might not cope up with that rising temperature. So they might move to a different place, or there could be mismatch in what they eat, for example, the phenology. So there is this wonderful bird songs all over the world that really make us happy, but at the same time, we are losing this amazing diversity of bird songs. Yeah.
Michael emailed to say that European starlings sing at frequencies above what people can hear. Do the recording devices that are designed for humans capture those very high frequencies?
Yes, there are birds and there are species out there that do, sing and make vocalizations above, you know, hearing frequencies, you know. So we as humans, normally we can hear from 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz, but above that would be ultrasonic. And yes, we might not be able to hear, but there are recorders and microphones out there that can record these calls and songs. And for example, most of the bats use ultrasonic, and elephants use infrasonic. So, we can listen to them and we can record them.
And just as commenting, Beverly emailed to say, robins definitely have a rain song. They said they've heard it many times when it rains. And I think your response or your comment on the sound pattern, the acoustical pattern that's going on would force them to do that.
Yep. I think so. I think, that's fantastic. Yeah. It's amazing that's the beauty of birds being there, and also our connection with the birds is that, you know, now when you're out there, you know, if, for example, if you hear a bird with a higher frequency, you can say that, this could be a smaller bird species because of this study that we have done, you know, or it could be, you know, or if you're walking in the woods and you hear a, you know, sound with, which is a very low frequency, and you could possibly say that could be a very large bird, like a crane or something, or, definitely not a winter wren.
Let's take a large bird. Let's see, great hornbill.
Oh, yes, fantastic.
Found in Southeast Asia.
Yep.
Just sort of a series of deep, what would you call it, grunts?
Yep.
What's going on with that, or why do they do it? That,
you know? If you get an opportunity, have a look at them live or online. I mean, these are great hornbills. They're fantastic birds. They're really big, you know, canopy birds, and they're frugivores, and also they eat insects and other meat. And they're really quite large birds. So, and have really quite a big bill. So that is a classic example of what is happening here, right? You know, because it's a large bird, it's the frequency that it's using is quite, you know, low. And it helps it to kind of have have this bird song heard at a very, wide range, because it needs that very high, you know, large tracts of forest. And at the same time, its beak is also very big. And that also independently, you know, without even the effect of body size, the beak itself makes a big, difference in what frequency you can call with. And what we found was larger beaks tend to be irrespective of your body size, independent of your body size, you will be forced to have a very low frequency. And so that's why, great hornbills, when you listen to them, you will not mistake them for a winter wren, for sure, because they have a very low frequency, very loud, but very low. Yeah. Very reverberating also.
I was trying to think of some other pileated woodpeckers. They have a little bit longer beak or a different shape beak, and their sound is
quite different, and it is loud, but also it has a very kind of a lower frequency when it compared to other woodpeckers, for example, like a downy or a hairy. So
beak size in this case may be the reason for the lower sound.
And still, pileated is still a smaller bird when you compare to the larger birds out there, you know. So, yes, beak size does make a big difference in what low.
Sounds like they're laughing.
They're like, well, you'll still not be able to find out. They're just laughing at us because we are not able to find out all the secrets that they have. I mean.
Well, it's interesting. So the is the shape of the beak then?
It's the
is it not only the length but the shape?
Yeah, it's the overall size. So we measured it as length by breadth by height, you know, like how big the beak is. So it's like the overall volume of the beak. So it was like how big the beak would be, for example. Yeah.
I'm thinking of another bird that has the loon. And actually, Bob and Mercer said in northern Wisconsin, loons, you know, they're common in most lakes.
Yep.
And their call is particularly And that's as a part. There's another kind of a warble that they do, which I think is. There's nothing like listening to.
Nothing like listening to loons. I think it's fantastic, and it's.
So yeah. do birds have vocal cords?
They have sirens. Yes.
They have what? I'm sorry.
What do you mean by sorry? Vocal cords. Yes, they do. They do have a bird version of vocal cords called siring. So this let these birds to kind of make these sounds by reverberating the bones there just like shake in such a way that you can make these sounds.
Okay, so it's all right. So that's obviously quite different from what we've got.
Yeah.
Karen in Rice Lake has something. Let's go there. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I don't know where I heard this, but it was that bird songs affect our nervous system as people, and then other animals possibly as well, as a signal of safety. And then when the birds go quiet, we automatically are aware that something has changed or there may be danger. Could be a weather change or that a predator is near.
Huh. Quite interesting.
I think they might. Well, you know, if I thought someone was looking for me, like a hawk.
I'd
be quiet.
Well, I mean, there are quite a lot of songbird species that don't call during a certain time of the time, and there are some, you know, there.
Nope.
So. Sorry.
No, that's right.
So there are some instances where birds might not call and sing because of the low pressure system when there's a approaching storm or something like that. So they might not be calling. You know, that's something that we have observed. So a predator for a bird could be a different for a predator for a human. Mm-hmm. So yes, as you said, a hawk might be approaching or something else. So they might stop. Some calling.
And then other birds, let's take wild turkeys. Now, here in Wisconsin, we have a lot of turkeys.
Which is good, yeah.
And they will call, they have different calls depending on, well, that's a gobbler.
Yeah.
And they will have different calls sometimes to attract.
Yeah, so sometimes you attract a mate, and also sometimes as a warning call, which is some species go silent, and some species actually let out this warning call saying that yes, I can see the predator. I'm alerting the other species that are around. And interestingly, we did not use the calls of these species to do this study, so it was majorly on songs, But yeah, calls and repertoire of calls also are a big part of these species.
Mark emailed to ask if birds ever lose their voice when they catch a cold or something. Do they get laryngitis?
Like siringitis. I don't know. I think sometimes they do lose their voice. I mean, it is all anecdotal, by the way. We do have a catbird that sings next to our house the whole night and even early morning, and I have no idea why. I mean, we know why, but it sings so much that at the end of the summer, sometimes it just has such a harsh voice, and we are like, it's okay, just relax. It's after the breeding season, so you can relax now, but it's like all harsh and scratchy. I mean, I know that I shouldn't be talking about anecdotal evidence, but sometimes
right.
You just look at these things and you're like, I think they might, it does put a lot of pressure on their sirens, and it does put a lot of pressure on their body system when they are calling. And there is something called environmental stress hypothesis, is that some individuals which are not fit enough might not call the same way than the same within the same species.
Yeah.
If one individual is living in the forest that has amazing food structure and amazing food and habitat, they might have be fit enough to call louder and call for longer and call more times than the individuals that might be in a next door forest but might be disturbed and not have enough food. So, you know, in a way, how we are and how fit we are does affect and how much we can call and how loud, you know, we can call. And yeah, so
that makes a lot of sense. Bob in Sparta says Bob has a whippoorwill behind his home that calls constantly and won't go away, depriving them of sleep.
I think it does. They might call a long time and, you know, it does deprive you of sleep. But sometimes I feel like, you know, I think people might lose their sleep over not listening to them. And I think that is something that, because then you can't get the species back. And I think that's more scary for me. Like, I might get annoyed by this, you know, one bird calling, you know, for example, the catbird that calls all the time. But I know that I will lose more sleep when I not listen to the catbird because I know something has happened to them. And yeah. I think that's more scary. And I don't know.
That's a good point. Yeah. Christina in Glenwood City has something. Let's go there. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. I am responding to the question about birds losing their voice. I have a canary, Sonny is his name. He has an incredibly beautiful voice.
Oh, fantastic.
However, when he molts once a year, in July, he loses his ability to sing. He tries, but he cannot until he's done with his molting.
Wow. That's a fantastic observation. Wow, that's amazing.
That's something there's nothing that you've looked at.
No.
Yeah.
Well, that's amazing. Wow, yeah, there'll be some. Wow, that is fantastic.
Thank you, Christina.
Yeah.
Appreciate the call.
Yeah.
And you could join in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking about bird songs today and some global research led by our guest today, Sathya Chandra Sagra, about bird songs and their meaning and how they vary depending on the bird species. It's been great talking with him today. And you can join in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. We had a song, a male ostrich has a very distinctive warning call. Ooh, ooh, ooh.
That's a fantastic call. I mean, you know, like, it's a very, very low frequency call, and you can hear that for kilometers, you know, and they live in such, you know, harsh conditions and in such open landscapes that they want to communicate with very, you know, various different species, so various different individuals of the same species. So they're like, well, you know, so that's a classic physics, right? If you sing at a very high frequency, the noise, the sound doesn't travel for further. So what it wants is, it wants to make a really low frequency sound. So the low frequency sound travels much further. And thanks to its amazingly large body size, it can make this really low frequency sound. And
it's also flightless. Would that play would a flightless, and would there are other flightless birds, I guess?
Yes, yes.
I wonder if that was, if it might be, it's not unique at all to flightless birds?
You know, it's a great question, Larry.
Because
and
they
can't fly
away from danger.
Yeah, and I don't think that, I don't test that hypothesis, and I don't know whether that can hold good everywhere, but I don't know, I'll look into it, but definitely there are high frequency, smaller birds that are flightless in islands. So I don't know whether this is a specialty, but yeah.
Roger in Sun Prairie has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Roger.
I've got two things for you, Larry Mueller. One is, can you play the call of an ostrich or an emu or both? But the big thing I wanted to call about is you're earlier in this program, you were talking about birds losing their voice. Well, the turkey in the spring will gobble, and they gobble so much that towards the end of the breeding season, they barely can gobble at all. And with the turkey, they have a real deep early, and then at the end, it's just.
Oh, yeah. Well,
we and you, Roger, you might have just missed it because you were getting online, but we did just play an ostrich call.
Yeah, we did. That was fantastic. coincidence. Wow.
I heard the turkey gobble, but not the end of his voice range when he ran out of gobble, so I didn't hear that.
Okay. Oh man.
But that's amazing. I mean, that you're able to, like, I think this is a fascinating thing about, like, you know, people loving bird songs. You go out and listen to them, and I think it just is magical. You know, I think it's,
Travis in Madison has something, too. Let's go there. Hi, Travis.
Hey, how's it going, gentlemen? I was just curious. You guys were talking about turkeys and stuff, and as a turkey hunter and stuff, I always thought it was fascinating that turkeys and crows have a relationship where they'll either check out a crow call if you make a crow call as a hunter, or vice versa. They kind of communicate with each other, and I thought that was always interesting, but didn't know much about it, and I thought maybe you guys might be able to tell me more.
Hmm. So I should be honest and say I do not know these kind of relationships, particularly with a crow, with the turkey here. But however, those kind of mutual relationships does exist. And it doesn't mean I don't know them. I'm sure there are, like, people who might have studied this kind of relationships, but species, like, for example, in Asia and Africa, there are species like drongos. They make a warning call, and based on these calls, there are other species that either go out when there are, you know, no predators, for example, and they go out and, you know, are leisurely hunting and eating other things. But when the drongo makes a call and all the other animals are like, oh, you know, there's a falcon coming, or there's a hawk or an eagle, so let's just go back. So, yeah, so there is this mutual relationship between, you know, birds and other species, for example, meerkats. Yeah, so I wouldn't say no, that this kind of exists, you know, relationship doesn't exist. But I'm not very specifically don't know anything about, but it's fantastic to know. I think it'll be awesome to see. Yeah.
One of your takeaways from your research was that bird species living at the same latitudes make similar sounds.
So what the extension of that kind of...
Because you had a global study, so you were looking at latitudes.
Yeah, yeah. So what the extension of that kind of the thought was that that amongst, you know, like, species across the tropics will have very similar kind of, you know, like a frequency range.
Yeah.
You know, like, or frequency bandwidth, what we could say. And that bandwidth, which is similar across the tropics, will be very different in the temperate regions. So what we found was the bandwidth of the birds that are found in the tropical landscapes are much smaller than the bandwidth that we found of the species in the temperate landscape, like in Wisconsin or compared to Costa Rica, for example. And we were like, you know, it makes sense. But one of the reasons that we got, you know, we thought was because of the high species diversity. You know, like Costa Rica or Panama or, for example, you know, parts in India have 2,000 species, 3,000 species of birds. And not, you know, you can, not every bird can have different, there's only so much bandwidth that is exist that, you know, we can hear, you know, even the birds can listen to. So so because of this high species diversity, they are always, you know, trying to have a very small niche, I would say, or a small bandwidth. It's like a symphony, for example. You know, if an orchestra has lots of equipment, all of them will play in a very, in a very set frequency. But if there are only two people, three people playing instruments, you can play drums in a very low or like, you know,
yeah,
high frequency. So and I think, you know, or a keyboard, for example. So I think that is what's happening. So most species, they all want to adjust. and that's, you can see that across, you know, the tropics or across the temperate. Yeah.
Here's something interesting. Michael emailed to ask, can researchers estimate the frequencies produced by extinct birds larger than living birds, such as moas or elephant birds, terror birds?
That's a fantastic question. And I think, I mean, the science has gone so much that we could potentially say what frequencies that they are doing based on their bone structure or based on the size. And, you know, we could come to a point where this is the frequency that they're using. But what, I'm sorry, I'm going back again to the conservation of this and the loss of these species is because, for example, you know, like a dodo, you know, was still alive until recently, until we drove them to extinction. We could potentially say what frequency they were calling in, but we'll never know the song of the dodo, because that modulation that it might be doing, the complexities that it might be bringing in. And I think that is lost forever. And I think yes and no. So one way we can know the frequency, but we can't really know how beautiful that song, what that bird could do with just that frequency, you know. And I think that's beautiful. And I think also it's lost. So, yeah.
And Cheryl in Bessemer, Michigan, had a comment on brown thrashers, but just the smaller bird species, why did they have a much wider range of frequencies? And you kind of went on, it talked about that a little bit, but maybe expand on that for, you know, the more vulnerable birds tend to have a wider range.
Yeah. So the smaller, I mean, you know, so what we found was like the smaller birds tend to kind of also, while they are, you know, through the body mass and beak size, they tend to have higher frequency notes, but they also try to make lower frequency calls, you know, lower than what you would predict, you know, what their song would be. And that is just, you know, that is one of the hypotheses called is size exaggeration, you know. So, and I think if you're exaggerating your size, because over the years, species adapt to a certain rhythm of the nature. You know, they'll know that, okay, that call or that song at this frequency means, you know, it could be an ostrich or a large bird. But and in nature, it's always a race for survival. You know, it's like, you know, it's always a race for survival. So in a way that, you know, in that race, they're trying to be like, okay, you know, we could make ourselves look or seem bigger, despite not being. And I think, you know, and that's fascinating. And I think that shows the complexities of these.
Well, in our last minute or so, what's next for you here? I mean, I'm sure you've got so much data to work with.
Yeah, and I think one of the next things that we are trying to do is relate these frequency characteristics to their threatened status. You know, someone just asked about the extinct species, and we are trying to see if, like, critically endangered or endangered birds, do they seem to have a certain frequencies, you know? So this comes with an hypothesis that usually large-bodied species tend to be more threatened towards extinction, either because they need, you know, they have very large life cycles or need large habitats to survive, or they're good meat. So, and a lot of people have hunted down to extinction or to being very endangered. So we're trying to see if, just by looking at the species frequency in a forest, can we say, well, these groups of species that are having, for example, low frequency might be more threatened, is something that we want to do in the future. And and another one would be to try and understand not just the frequency characteristics, but also the temporal characteristics. You know, now we just looked at the frequency, but we can see, you know, how the rate of complexity changes. So that's the next
That's the next. Satya, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. And I hope we have a chance to do this again. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for all the listeners. And it's been a pleasure of mine to study the birds and also share this wonderful story. Thank you so much.
Satya Chandra Sagra, our guest today, a conservation scientist and recent PhD graduate from the UW-Madison Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Pleasure to have him with, and a pleasure to have you listening in. And thanks so much for listening. And stay with us. Lots more in store on WPR News.